there's a great fascination and excitement around obesity treatment, but I would like it to be boring. I'd like it to be where we sort of accept that, yeah, I can go to my medical provider and that team and get support and treatment, and that treatment will be comprehensive and safe and without judgment.
Welcome to the Good Clean Nutrition Podcast. I'm your host, Ginger Holton, a registered dietitian nutritionist. Today, we're talking with Dr. Jamie Ard. He is a clinical researcher focused on studying strategies to treat obesity in adults. He co-directs the Wake Forest Baptist Health Weight Management Center, where he oversees medical weight management programs. In the last episode with Dr. Ard, we talked about the complexities around treating obesity. Today, we're focusing on weight loss medications, the evolving role of nutrition in treatment, where the research has been done, and where it's still needed. But before we dive in, I was at a big nutrition conference a few years ago, and I was going to one of the hottest topics, and it was very controversial. There was a weight loss physician having a debate with a health at every size, weight inclusive dietitian. And the dietitian that was leading the debate got up and she said to the audience, "I just want to acknowledge first that every person is here because we care so much about our patients and we want to help them." And I thought that it was such an incredible way of framing it, because even though within the dietetics community and the medical community, there's a bit of a debate back and forth. Do we practice weight loss and support weight loss, or do we let go of that and focus on other parameters of health? I've always considered in my practice that it's probably more complex than that, and maybe we need a little bit of both. But one thing I do know at the end of the day is that you're more than just your body size, and it's a topic that we really need to be talking more openly about. For the latest nutrition tips and science, follow the show wherever you get your podcasts. Welcome, Dr. Ard.
Thank you.
To open it up, the word Ozempic is everywhere right now. It's in the media. A lot of folks are taking it. It's not just Ozempic. There's several drugs in the same class. Can you give us an overview and a better sense of what these drugs are?
Yeah, let's start with just talking about, I guess, what a lot of people are hearing. It's a GLP-1 drug or GLP-1 based therapy. And that category currently includes two medications that are approved for the treatment of obesity. And the generic names are semaglutide and tirzepatide. Semaglutide has the two brands associated with it, Ozempic, which everybody knows because of the song. And then Wegovy is the brand that's supposed to be used for obesity treatment. Ozempic is for type 2 diabetes treatment. And tirzepatide similarly has two brands. You have Mounjaro, which is for diabetes, and Zepbound, which is for obesity. There's no difference between Wegovy and Ozempic. It's the same drug. They just come in different pens. Ozempic goes up to 2 milligrams. Wegovy goes up to 2.4 milligrams. Mounjaro and Zepbound, same exact drug. Tirzepatide, they actually are even dosed the same. They go up to 15 milligrams. Just brand name differences. That's all. Those are the, you know, sort of basics. And there are a lot of other drugs in that category that are in pipeline, like in development. So if we would have this conversation 5 years from now, we'll be talking about a few new drugs probably on the market. Same general types of mechanism of action, but probably a few little sort of extra things that are different. There's differences between semaglutide and tirzepatide. But GLP-1 is a thing that is common between the two of them.
Thank you for breaking that down. I'm seeing all of them used, sometimes people jumping back and forth between them.
Yeah.
What I hear most of the time is people saying it quiets the food noise. I'd like to hear from you how it works. Like, what is it doing in the body?
GLP-1 based treatments tend to work in a couple of different areas that we know of. Let's start with the periphery or the stomach in that area first. We know it delays the gastric emptying. How long does it take for your stomach to empty the contents after you've eaten something? It slows that down and slows it down to varying degrees in different people. Originally, the science seemed to suggest that this was a minor component to why it worked. Because you can imagine if you don't empty the contents of your stomach as quickly, you stay full longer. You have less hunger between meals, less likely to, say, do unplanned snacking. And when you get to the next eating episode, you're just not as hungry as you would have been before. That's one component of how it may work. And as we're using it in practice, we start to see this variability. Some people get a lot of delay in gastric emptying to the point where if you're going for, say, a surgical procedure, they might tell you stop taking this drug 2 weeks beforehand because they want to be sure that when you fast overnight before the procedure, that your stomach's going to be empty. That piece of the contribution to weight reduction, it's more significant than what we maybe originally thought, but it's not the major reason that you're seeing this dramatic change in terms of how people respond to the treatment. The other area where it works is in the brain. We have an area in the hypothalamus that is responsible for helping us determine when we're hungry, how much we want to eat, how hungry we feel, and then when we feel full, when we get that signal of, oh, okay, you've had enough. Some of my patients don't have that internal signal. Like their only cue to stop eating is that the food is gone or, you know, they've got a partner who's giving them the, you've had enough, you need to stop now. And one of the things that's really remarkable about these drugs is that a lot of people will notice it's like the volume on that sense of fullness gets turned up. They can now much more easily sense internally that, yeah, I've had enough to eat. And that volume gets turned up to a point where they're feeling that sense of fullness much earlier in the course of a meal. They're, by default, the portion control that you might have to work with your patients on historically, right? You're using different strategies to help people, you know, sort of portion out smaller portions and feel full visually, right? Now, the medication is doing that for them. That's a really important component about what's happening. We also think that this medication is decreasing some of what we call the hedonic drive for food or hedonic response to food. It's the idea that, you know, I like a good piece of cake. If there's cake in the house, I might have a slice and then I'm done and I won't think about cake till the next day. Some of my patients will find that if there's cake in the house, I might have a slice now and then I'm going to come back later in a couple hours and have another slice. And then that sense of reward that comes from that food, again, is centrally mediated. It's in the brain. These drugs, apparently, from what we can tell clinically, a lot of people will find that a sense of reward goes down. So, yeah, it was good, but I can take it or leave it, right? The idea that I can have a donut out of a dozen and the rest of the dozen is going to feel safe, that's a new thing for a lot of my patients. We think that there's some specific effect of GLP-1 receptors in the brain having some direct effect on that sense of reward eating. And you can see how that might spill over into someone who might have more emotional eating or someone who might have binge eating tendencies where they will feel like they lose control with eating. That's why, again, this is broadly helpful, is that many people with many different sort of phenotypes, if you will, like different reasons for how their brain deals with food and why they might gain excess weight, because it covers a lot of those areas in some ways.
Yeah, it's like it hits on some of the biggest challenges that as clinicians we hear over and over and over. But I wanted to loop back to something you said about variability. And I get a lot of my patients coming to me confused about that. They'll say things like, well, someone else I know lost tons of weight, but I'm not really losing weight, or I'm not really noticing a difference in my hunger or satiety. So there seems to be a wide range of the way that people respond to these medications.
Very few things that we do lead to a universal 100% response. Amputation is the only thing that I can think of that when we take it off, it's gone, and 100% of the time it's there. But this is one of the challenges that we face in this space, is that we have a disease that we have not yet been able to fully characterize. Our characterization of obesity is based on BMI. right? It's based on height and weight in that proportion. But that tells you absolutely nothing about the disease state that the person has. It doesn't tell you about where the body fat is. It doesn't tell you how long they've had obesity. It doesn't tell you about any of the brain-related food regulation issues in terms of, is this person a hedonic eater? Are they an emotional eater? Are they binge eating? Is that part of it? Do they have food addiction? Do they have food noise, right? You know, all of those things. So I have some patients who don't have the food noise issue, but they might have the lack of satiation issue. And that's where they find like, yeah, that's incredibly helpful. So there's definitely a wide variety of presentations, if you will, in terms of the type of obesity that you might have. We actually think of it as obesities, right? It's not just one disease. It's any number of different causes and combinations of factors that create a unique case for each person.
Yeah, I think about cancer the same way. Like, it's not just one thing. It's incredibly complex. It's 500 different things.
Yeah.
I didn't think of obesity that way. That's fascinating. There are some classifications that people have to meet, criteria. Maybe it's BMI, obesity, maybe it's blood sugar levels. Who is this drug for? Like, who do you like to give it to the most that's going to be most helpful?
There are a few different characteristics. So one, let's start with individuals who find that other strategies have not worked despite their best efforts. They've tried other things and they have complex disease, meaning they've got either a much higher BMI or they have limitations in terms of their capacity to be able to implement certain aspects of their treatment. For example, a patient who needed to get both of her hips replaced. You can imagine that being physically active is not really an option for her. Sure, she could do some upper body related things, but even sitting up for any extended period of time was painful. In this case, we're working with fewer tools to start off with, just based on the fact that both of her hips are bad. A treatment like this that I know can be effective in driving weight reduction independent of a large volume of physical activity is going to be really helpful. That's what I'm looking for, because I know that this is going to give me on average a better, larger volume weight loss. I'm starting with patients who might be heavier, need to lose a larger amount of weight. Patients who have diabetes are clearly going to be good candidates for a treatment like this, or significant insulin resistance like PCOS, for example. We're also finding that patients who have fatty liver, metabolic associated liver disease, these individuals are getting a lot of benefit from use of GLP-1 based treatments. And then I think if we get into some of those sort of individual characteristics around how people deal with food or perceive food, people who tend to not get that signal to stop eating, I find that the GLP-1 based therapies can be really helpful. Food noise can be one of those things that makes me think about GLP-1, but some of our other strategies like phentermine and phentermine topiramate combination can be really helpful for that food noise component too. I like to say for people, you're thinking about food a lot, but you get a sense of when you're full. Like, you can feel that sense of fullness, but it's just the, I'm ready to eat again in another hour if food is around, or if food is around, I tend to pay attention to it a lot. Then something like phentermine or phentermine topiramate can actually be really helpful and exactly hit what I need to hit without other side effects that I don't want.
Right. And those are what you were calling earlier the older class of medication?
Yeah. These are the medications that we have had on the market now for, depending on the type of medicine, since the early 2000s, or phentermine in that case, longer, or things that we might use off-label. Topiramate or Topamax is an example of something that doesn't have an indication for obesity treatment, but specialists like myself will use off-label as a way to help address a particular issue. And it has been studied for obesity, but the rate limiting factor was at the higher doses, you get a lot of side effects with it. Not everyone tolerates it. It makes it hard to get it through as approved for the indication of obesity when you have a lot of side effects at that higher level. But it can be incredibly helpful. Like, if I have patients who say, Yeah, I just find that I'm drinking a lot of soda and it's hard for me to get away from soda, or in the South, sweet tea. Using topiramate can really sort of create it has a nice side effect of making carbonated beverages, sugar sweetened beverages taste pretty nasty. And so people will just stop drinking it. And it's a nice sort of benefit of it, but it can be a useful tool that way.
I did not know that is a side effect of those medications. That's really interesting.
Yeah. It's called dyskinesia, change in taste.
Wow. I could see how that could be very helpful. I was getting tea the other day here in Seattle and somebody asked if it was sweet tea. And I said, no, we never have sweet tea in Seattle. It doesn't exist here.
You got to bring your own.
You definitely do. Definitely. But you talked about side effects, especially of the injectables, like the GLP-1 medications. My patients are struggling a lot with those. I'm seeing nausea all the time, some vomiting, and then also diarrhea. Sometimes I would call it profound or severe. And then also I have one or two folks that are going the other way and having like really serious constipation. Is that what you're seeing too?
In general, I think that the majority of patients can tolerate these medications if they are getting the right type of guidance and support. It is important to realize that the experience has been through the clinical trials that 80-85% of people in the clinical trials experience some side effect, and often nausea is the number one thing, but it will be some GI related type of side effect most commonly. And you name them all, right? Nausea, reflux, burping, diarrhea, and constipation. Hydration is another important component. These drugs can make people feel less thirsty. Fatigue is another side effect that I tend to see more often than what's reported in the clinical trials. But the nice thing about these treatments is that with the right support and advice, slow titration and time, most people will generally do just fine. But I always remind people, if you're having significant side effects, don't try to tough it out. This is not something you want to show up to your doctor's office and say, well, yeah, for the past year, I've been, on the toilet 5 times a day. That's not what you want to do. There's a better way to manage that, and you need to definitely talk to your medical team to say, this is what I'm experiencing. How do I minimize that? Or is there an alternative treatment that I need to get to?
Yeah, I will say as a dietitian, I've been having a lot of joy working with the complexity that these medications bring, because one thing dietitians are real good at is managing these nutrition impact side effects.
Yeah, it's really nice to be able to see a tool that frees up people to actually be able to focus in on the healthy eating without all of the cognitive angst.
Right.
And what I see is that in our practices, people are starting to feel like, whoa, this is what normal feels like. And when I get to a meal, I can be satisfied with the smaller portion, the healthier choice. Like I'm not missing out on something. Whereas before, that mental gymnastics of having to sit there and say, that looks good. I wish I could have some, but I know I can't because I'm on my diet. And that is hard for a lot of our patients to have to do that mental gymnastics all day, every day.
Yeah, I find that really sets people up for failure. Orgain's all-in-one nutrition shakes are formulated for everyday nutrition and cater to a variety of health needs and conditions. Available in dairy and plant-based options, these shakes have been carefully crafted to deliver 16 grams of high-quality protein, along with up to 22 essential vitamins and minerals, and a wholesome blend of organic fruits and veggies. For little ones, Orgain offers plant and dairy-based organic kids shakes balanced with 8 grams of protein, essential nutrients, and a delicious mix of fruits and veggies. Even the pickiest kids will be asking for more. Take charge of your health and the well-being of others with Orgain. Visit Orgain.com today to explore the full range of product. One thing I wanted to run by you that I have struggled with is when people aren't doing this correctly, I've found that some people are under eating. They're feeling fatigued because they're not getting enough calories. Their hair is falling out, which is a major trigger for me as a dietitian. And so sometimes I'll have folks food tracking and I'm like, what exactly is happening? They're eating like 600 or 700 calories. Are you seeing that too?
Yeah, we see that fortunately in our program because we have great dietitians and we're able to educate people and give them an anticipation of like, this is what you can expect. And here's why we insist on the things that we do in terms of a meal structure and pattern that is not always tied to, oh, I feel hungry, because you're going to experience a lack of hunger that may not be familiar to you. And you're going to look up and say, oh, I had something for breakfast, but I haven't, it's, you know, 5 o'clock and I've not had anything else all day. I'll have this bag of popcorn when I get home and then I'm done for the day. So yeah, we see that tendency all the time. And we have to really structure the intake with patients to get them to understand, like, your body still needs nutrition and your path to weight reduction, to healthy weight loss, good quality weight loss is not to just eat as little as possible. It's actually to eat a good, healthy diet that's appropriately fueling what you want to accomplish. And just reminding people of that and saying, okay, we're going to retrain you during this time. And hopefully that sets them up to do well longer term.
I've even said the words to people, you can't just not eat. That is not the point here at all. But, you know, people are so programmed to like, less is better, eat less, that's how I get where I want to go. So I do a lot of education around that. And I have people set timers because you're right, they completely forget to eat and then you're not meeting your nutrient needs. And then your hair is falling out.
And your muscle mass is declining disproportionately. And this is where we get into that, again, that idea of quality of weight loss. I think we're quickly moving in the field as we have the introduction of these newer treatments that can get us larger volume weight loss from just judging what percent weight loss did we get to now being able to say what percent fat loss did we get and how much lean mass did we actually sustain with the weight reduction that we got, because that may be more important in the longer term. And for some of our patients, especially like older adults, it's going to be important right now. We don't want to create situations where people are less healthy overall, but smaller. That's not the outcome we want.
And you mentioned earlier, just being in a slighter body does not mean you're naturally healthier. I was at a conference this week, somebody was speaking about bone health and saying that they are worried with rapid weight loss, sometimes because of these injectables. We are seeing bone mass take a hit. And I know muscle mass also, and we have to be really careful to protect that.
Yeah, absolutely. That's an area of interest of ours in terms of research. I have a colleague who's leading a couple of studies in that space, one around bariatric surgery and prevention of bone mass loss, and another around comparing couple of different strategies to prevent bone mass loss with weight reduction in older adults. But we know with the volume of weight loss that we're seeing that some of our patients, especially those who come in with low bone mass to begin with, osteopenia, will be tipping over into osteoporosis. And I saw an early report not too long ago that suggests that, yeah, you're starting to see an uptick in some hip fractures associated with, you know, kind of broader use. So it is something that we've got to keep our eye on. And fortunately, a lot of this is preventable. There's a lot more research that needs to be done in order to understand what that optimized intake looks like at the lower calorie target with the use of these medications in particular. But I think we have a good sense of where we need to go.
People can just get these from the mail now. Like, people are just getting these medications and taking them. But I'm seeing many challenges. I mean, I didn't know it was up to 85%, seeing pretty intense side effects. And, you know, we're talking about bone loss. We're talking about under eating. People really need to be working with a physician and dietitian, it sounds like.
Yeah. We're talking about a chronic health condition. We're talking about very powerful medication that is essentially mimicking hormones that your body naturally produces. And you can absolutely get into some significant complications that without the right counseling support could have a real negative consequence in terms of your health that could be worse than where you started. One of the things that I'm hopeful that will evolve over time in the treatment of obesity space is that we will move from this idea that you just have to take a quick shot, take a pill, and everything else will fall into place. Like, we've got plenty of history to know that that's not the case. And as we bring these newer treatments that are much more powerful into the arena, I think we're going to have to retool our health system and train people, clinicians and so forth, create the workforce to be able to support better treatment. Because going back to this idea of quality of weight reduction, I think that's going to be our ultimate metric, is being able to say, yeah, in order to see the health improvements that we want, we've got to put all these things together.
And you just highlighted something that I really want to talk about, which is calories in versus calories out. I am really struggling with this concept. I have for a long time, and I talk about it a lot with my clients. But what do you think about the mantra of just burn more calories than you take in?
Fundamentally, I start off with the concept of you can't create weight loss without an energy deficit. In order to see loss of fat mass, you have to have some type of energy deficit in order to be able to access those fat stores and burn those calories that are stored there. Otherwise, that just doesn't happen. In order to create an energy deficit, you have a number of different ways that you could do that. You could exercise a bunch. It's a very inefficient way to create an energy deficit. And women, unfortunately, don't create that energy deficit with exercise alone very well. And those studies that have been done with just adding exercise, women tend not to lose very much, maybe a couple kilos. Men can lose more, but again, the volume of exercise has to be pretty high, and most people will have a compensatory response where you get more efficient and you tend to get hungrier. That's why you go to the Starbucks after the gym, right? That is one way to do it, exercise only. The other way to do it is through food. And as you know, right, it's a very efficient way to reduce your calorie intake, is by decreasing the calorie density or the volume of food or both. But you do have to, as a final pathway, often reduce the energy intake. Now, you can create energy deficit in other ways by malabsorption, for example. So some surgical procedures or orlistat creates malabsorption by not absorbing all the calories, and you pass some of those calories out in your stool. That can get a little messy. It is part of a strategy to help you potentially waste calories, and then you create an energy deficit that way. The one strategy that we've historically never really had success with is increasing resting metabolic rate. You can think of drugs that have tried to do that, ephedrine, things that really kind of raise your heart rate and make you sweat a lot, and you just sort of burning all this, you know, energy off. But those drugs have, you know, historically just been dangerous. And so it's hard to create an energy deficit by just burning more calories at rest. So ultimately, based on what we understand and know, the final common pathway to create an energy deficit is most efficiently achieved by reducing food intake and usually some combination of increased physical activity to help support the skeletal muscle lean mass, as well as keep your resting energy expenditure from totally tanking when you start to reduce your energy intake. That's the way I think about it. Yes, you have to create an energy deficit. Reducing food intake is a part of that. But the problem with the calories in, calories out mantra is that it's very simplified. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't take into account, once you start to reduce your calorie intake, all of the compensatory things that happen where your brain says, you must be starving, and we're going to do everything that we can to preserve your body mass, and starts to adjust these things so that you don't waste away. Your brain doesn't know that you're doing that on purpose. It thinks this is something bad, and it doesn't want you to turn into a snowman and melt away. That's the complexity that calories in, calories out doesn't capture.
I push back on that a lot, but I really appreciate you saying we need to create a deficit. That part is true. And you do need to burn more than you're taking in. But I talk to my clients. I'm like, how old are you? What's your muscle mass? What's your fat mass? What are your hormones doing? Yeah. What's your inflammation doing? What's your relationship to food? There's much more along the path to creating a calorie deficit. Like you said, it's way too oversimplified. And I do think it works against people.
To your point, we don't have a great way of accurately defining the calorie out. You can put on your Fitbit and go around all day and it's going to give you an estimate of what your energy expenditure was for the day. But the accuracy of that, based on all those things that you just listed off, could be wildly off, right? I mean, I've got patients who are on medications that are going to have a negative impact on their energy expenditure and insulin sensitivity. And so it creates this sort of positive energy balance, regardless of if they were consuming than the same number of calories that they were before they were on that medication. Now they've shifted into a positive energy balance simply because of the dynamics of that medication having an impact on their brain's, you know, sort of control, homeostatic control of energy intake and how your brain is handling energy. You were eating 2,000 calories a day before losing weight. Now you're eating 2,000 calories and you're gaining weight. Menopause is another example of that, right? You see that all the time. I'm sure women say, I've gained 10 pounds in the past few months and nothing's changed, but I'm perimenopausal. And again, not a calories in, calories out, simple equation. That equation has been altered as a result of a change in metabolic state. That's why, yeah, you still can't get weight loss until you either change that metabolic state. So I've had patients where we've actually used hormone replacement therapy, and then now they're losing weight again. Whereas before, they were following all of the right things that we recommended, but because of the menopausal state, they weren't losing weight. They weren't responding.
Thank you for bringing that up. We've been talking a lot about perimenopause and menopause, and it just creates even more complexity to an already complex situation.
Yes, yes, it does.
I really need to know, because all of my patients are asking, and I don't really know, what happens when we go off of these medications? What is that plan? Nobody in my world is talking about this. They just go on them.
Yeah. It goes back to the part of the question you asked earlier in terms of what are those considerations when we're thinking about starting the medication. Reiterating, we think long-term chronic disease, likelihood that you're going to be on it. But as you were talking about, let's talk about realistic expectations and what's happening in the real world. Yeah, people lose coverage for the treatment. People decide, hey, I just don't feel like giving myself a shot every week anymore. Or I'd like to try without it just because I have the sense that I want to try. In that case, I like to do a taper down. What I found is when people have to abruptly discontinue, especially those who had the food noise in the first place, they find that the rebound food noise is extraordinary. From the very beginning, they're noticing like it's worse than before. My hunger is hard to control. I'm binge eating again, right? It just sort of comes back really abruptly. And if we can anticipate we're going to try to come off, then I'd rather have a controlled descent on that dose to give our body time to adjust. Because what we're doing is we're giving people, you know, super physiologic doses of this hormone, and your brain, your body gets accustomed to that. We don't always have that luxury of knowing ahead of time that this is going to be the case. But when we do, that's what I like to try. The other thing that we do and try to focus on is, okay, we've been practicing these behaviors, right? We've been practicing the meal timing and the spacing. You naturally had the portion control. So now you kind of understand what that looks and feels like. You've gotten some internal cues that you start to tie into. The quality of what you're eating hopefully has changed over time. We've been coaching on that as well. And then we're building a physical activity program as that gets easier. As you're losing weight, you're more into it, that type of thing. So we're going to lean on those things really closely. We're going to, you know, supplement that with some good self-monitoring and make sure that all the other things are working as well. Sleep is really important, right? The hydration piece, and that we're doing self-care. So all of those things we're going to really kind of double down on. And then we're going to follow you closely for the first few weeks off of treatment to make sure that we're not seeing a signal that the weight is going up. Because if that signal is starting to appear early, then we want to jump on it. I'd rather lose 2 pounds 10 times than 20 pounds once.
Yeah.
We're going to figure out what do we need to do in order to deal with those small incremental changes and not just say, oh, okay, next week I got it. And that might mean we may not go back on the GLP-1. We could go on an alternative treatment that may be good enough to help us maintain. Could be an oral medication, could be something that we use only as needed. Mm. I've got a number of patients who take Phentermine if their weight is 5 pounds above their target.
Interesting.
They know, okay, I'm going to take this until I get back into my zone. Or they know, yeah, when Halloween comes around, there's extra candy around. It's harder to resist, right? Because it's in the house. I can't not have it in the house because of X, Y, and Z. I'm going to take my medication during that time to help me stay more consistent, or during the holiday season or whatever it may be. So there are lots of ways that we can work around that idea of not everybody wants to commit to a long-term treatment strategy or can commit to that because of resources or whatever. And then we're going to do our best to try to support the patient in that way.
Yeah. Taper down seems much more ideal because you taper up.
Yeah.
You and I are talking about exactly the same thing. When somebody's on this medication and the volume is turned down and you have the opportunity to partner, hopefully with some great medical providers, use that time to get onto a great path with the right nutrition, better habits that you wanted to do and probably just couldn't before. And then as you taper off, you can stabilize hopefully in those ways with support too, seems to be one of our major themes.
Yeah, absolutely.
I love it. I did want to ask about any stigma that you see with these medications. Do you see patients struggle with that? Do you struggle with that?
I do see that some of our patients deal with the stigma. And it's really sort of been interesting in that when people come to the idea that, yeah, okay, I'm ready to engage with the treatment and accept the help that this is going to provide for me, because of the lack of support or lack of understanding that they might have within their friend or family circles, they then have to keep it to themselves that they're using this treatment. Because a lot of people will report, hey, I get feedback about, well, you're just taking the easy way out, or is that really safe? So there are a lot of questions about it. And I think a lot of people just feel like, why should I have to justify my medical decision-making to everyone? No one is asking me about why you're taking that antihypertensive. This is a larger symptom of the societal perspective on treatment of obesity. The other statement I hear is like, well, you're taking the easy way out. And I'm like, what in life do you ask for? No, make this harder. I really need to prove myself to everyone. So make the difficulty of this as hard as you can. And it sort of baffles me, like we would criticize people or make them feel bad because they're getting assistance for something that has been challenging for them. And in my opinion, it comes from this sort of idea like we assign virtue to people who have been successful with a lifestyle-only approach. We hold them up as heroic and super disciplined and able to overcome the odds and beat it. And I'm not discounting what a lot of our patients do in terms of making healthy lifestyle changes and being able to implement that, get the health outcomes that they desire. That is wonderful. But that doesn't mean that we should expect that everyone can achieve that same outcome. Just because the person who's 6'10 can dunk the basketball doesn't mean that if I put on the same uniform and the same shoes and go on the same court that I'm going to be able to dunk a basketball. Why would we expect that just because someone else had the resources and the wherewithal and the biology to respond to a lifestyle-only intervention that everybody else should have to do that? My hope is that eventually we get past that and that we're able to accept that different people need different treatments. Just the same way we accept that different cancer patients are going to need different cancer treatments based on their genetics or based on the source of the disease or the location of the disease and the when in which it was diagnosed and all these other things. And one day we'll get there.
It's health equity, not treating everyone exactly equal. It's,
yeah.
I'm not going to dunk any basketballs either, to be honest. Not at all. Not at all. And I had one final question on this thread. Where do you want to see this conversation go? Like, where do you hope that it is 5 years from now, 10 years from now, in the media or in our culture?
You know, it's fun to say there's a great fascination and excitement around obesity treatment, but I would like it to be boring. I'd like it to be where we accept that, yeah, I can go to my medical provider and that team and get support and treatment, and that treatment will be comprehensive and safe and without judgment, and that people will accept that I am getting treatment and be supportive of that. I would love for that to be the case. And it's not a big deal that I'm taking this injectable or taking this pill as a part of my treatment plan, and that I'm going to do it long term. I'm going to get care long term for this chronic disease. If we can get to that point, then we've made a big difference in terms of the conversation.
Yeah, less emotionally charged. That would be really nice. Let's do this again in a few years and we'll see where we're at.
Okay.
And we'll just pick up there.
That sounds great.
Our show is sponsored by Orgain and produced in collaboration with Large Media. That's L-A-R-J Media. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Good Clean Nutrition Podcast. To stay up to date on the latest podcast episodes, be sure to hit follow on your podcast app. And if you like this podcast, I'd love for you to let us know. You can rate and review this show on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, or you can give us a thumbs up on YouTube if you're watching right now. I'm Ginger Holton. You can find me online at gingerholtonnutrition.com. Thanks so much for listening.